We're going to start with chanting some Karmapa channels. So Karmapa channel means Karmapa, please regard us, please know us, please see us. And so if you're not familiar with the Karmapa, although many of you in here are, but if you're not, you can just think of your spiritual benefactor or benefactors in the sky in front, and think of communing with them, connecting with them. And for us that are familiar with the Karmapa, we can see the Karmapa. So not the Karmapa far, far away in India, but the Karmapa here in this room. So my teacher, Kala Rinpoche, used to say that where the Guru is seen or visualized, there the Guru appears. So the Guru is no near and far. So Karmapa, no near and far. So in your case, if you don't know the Karmapa, you can just think of your spiritual benefactor or benefactors, whoever they may be, Buddhist or non-Buddhist, doesn't matter, in the sky in front, and just think of communing with them, connecting to them. And the prayer we're going to say is Karmapa Channel, very simple, with a tune. Karmapa Channel, 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 Karmapa And now visualize that your spiritual benefactor or benefactors dissolve into light and dissolve into you. And just rest with your body, speech, and mind, inseparable from the body, speech, and mind of your guides. Let go completely and let the Buddha meditate you. Relax into natural body, Lu Rangbap. Body left to settle on its own. notice the natural breath, not Rangba, which is breath breathing you. And mind, when left alone, settles on its own like a cup of water scooped up from a muddy river, settles out and becomes clear. Sem Rangbap, natural mind. And we use Saraha's instructions to sit with. This natural mind, if relaxed, will free itself. Have no doubt. This natural mind, if loosened, will free itself. Have no doubt. this natural mind. If we let go, liberates itself. Have no doubt. Namatang Gunjarimba Lovely to be back here at Vajra Vidya. Really nice to see everybody again. And nice to be in Maine this beautiful fall day, too. So lately, this fall, I have started exploring, going back and exploring some of the early poems and songs of the Mahasiddhas and Mahasiddhis, the men and the women of early Indian tantric practice, whose verses and poetry and songs inspired the Buddhist tradition. The tantric Buddhist tradition going back to the 9th century in India. And part of what inspired this is that lately I've been working on a dissertation, so I'm doing a lot of digging back in old texts and routing around and seeing what's there. And in doing that, I began to read some of the writings of Milarepa, and I mean the writings of Milarepa, Naropa, Marpa, not the later compilations of their work or the later commentaries on their work, which is much more what we inherit in English, like what we read in English, like the Life of Marpa and all those great books. Those were written centuries after these people lived. But I went back and dug around in their original texts and began noticing some things that were really striking that I didn't really know before, wasn't fully aware of. And one of the things I've discovered in doing this is that Naropa and Marpa and Milarepa, the practices that they actually did and the texts that they had to rely on at that time were very simple, not really complex. There were not extensive commentaries, except for in the Buddhist canon, like on the original tantras, there were some commentaries. But there was nothing in Tibetan. There were no extensive commentaries written on works in Tibetan at all. So what they were mainly relying on were very pared down, simple sadhanas that were not long, were not complicated, very rich, but not what we've inherited today. So, you know, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition out of which we are trained, in which we are trained, and in which we've grown up as some of us as Dharma people, although some of us very eclectically informed by other traditions as well. But to take that example, the Tibetan example, for example, I'm sure true in the Japanese tradition, true in the Theravada tradition also, there were centuries of time for the lineage to be kind of like a rolling stone, gathering lots and lots and lots of moss and sticks and stones and beautiful stuff. But boy, by the end, you've got this enormous boulder of really complex stuff, you know, complex sadhanas, complex commentaries. It got much more complex. But the earlier masters relied on some very, very simple, pithy instructions in their own practices that they quote from in their texts as being what has inspired them. And one of those masters that comes up again and again is Saraha. So Saraha is, even now, if you read more recent commentaries like The Ocean of Certainties and many of the works by the Karmapas, and later commentaries, say like Natsal Rangdrol's book on Mahamudra, all of the longer books on Mahamudra, they are constantly quoting Sanaha. And so in noticing that, I went back and reread Sadaha and am just so taken by his work. He's just an amazing poet. Who was Sadaha? So Sadaha lived in the 8th century. So we're talking 700, somewhere in there, AD, long time ago, many, many hundreds of years ago, in India, in northern India. And he was a wandering bard, poet, sometimes sedentary, sometimes wandering. His name, Sadaha, means the arrow maker, because that was his profession. He made arrows. And back then, that was an important profession because one of the ways you got your food was from farming, and the other way you got your food was from hunting. And so he made arrows, and as Buddhists, that might be kind of shocking to us. Oh my gosh, he was making weapons, making weapons. But, he was a tantric siddha, so he was also on a lot of, you'll see his songs are sort of about transcending judgment completely. And so he was very, kind of embodied that contradictions. He embodied contradictions. And he started out his life as a monk, as many of these siddhas did, or some of these siddhas did, and then ended up wandering away from the monastery and just wandering into the forest and meditating on his own and becoming a kind of wild tantric yogi kind of persona. Married, took up the profession of arrow making, and attained his enlightenment through his profession. So the story goes. And this is true with the siddhas, the Mahasiddhas, ones known as the Mahasiddhas in India, of which there were 84, ostensibly, but I'll bet there were more. 84 made it into, at least into one group of stories called the 84 Mahasiddhas is the name of these stories. And they can be found, if you're interested, really nice collection by Keith Dauman, translated by Keith Dauman. I don't know what it's called. Masters of Mahamudra, I think. Does that sound familiar? Does anyone know this book? No, not necessarily.
Masters of something,
right. And there's now a version with full color pictures of each of the Mahasiddhas. It's very cool. So these Mahasiddhas were, all of them, ordinary village folk. They were all just cobblers and arrow makers and sesame seed grinders. Talopa was one of them, by the way. He's in there. Housewives, just a whole a prostitute in there, too. I'm trying to think of some of the other professions. One who just raised dogs on an island. So just like this totally wide swath of people. Now, what's unique about the Mahasiddhas is, at least in their songs, the way they're famous for their songs. They're famous for their poems. Poems, songs, how do you want to see it? Probably songs. They were probably sung. They're all in verse. They're all very poetic and beautiful. They're known for their songs, these Mahasiddhas. We could say it was a tradition of poets, the Mahasiddha tradition. It was also a tradition of taking work as a path, which I think is a fantastic model for us in the West, this Mahasiddha model. These Mahasiddhas sing about how their profession of cobbling or their profession of sesame seed grinding was when they got their insight into liberation. Their insight is often coming through their profession, and that was true with Sadaha, too. He sang some songs about arrows and arrow making and taking the arrow as a symbol for the mind, straightening the mind, like an arrow maker straightens the string on a bow, these kinds of things, like an arrow maker straightens an arrow, these kinds of symbols. So So for us, the Mahasiddhas are a wonderful example of how work or life can be taken as a path, and then they express that through their songs. So Sadaha was one of the most eloquent Indian Buddhist poets, the most eloquent of the Mahasiddhas, and the most prolific. So he wrote many, or he wrote or sang. It's not certain if he wrote these down or if it was passed down orally, like many of these early traditions. Eventually, his songs got written down, and there was quite a collection of them. So the word for siddha, 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 is drupto, drupto, which means somebody who has practiced and accomplished. Practiced and accomplished. So that's what the word means. So a siddha, which is a kind of person like a bodhisattva, but a siddha is the term a siddha. Means one who is practiced and accomplished. And the term siddha also brings with it an implication that this person has practiced and accomplished through the methods of a tantric tradition. So you don't find siddhas in non-tantric traditions. They're always in tantric traditions, which means that siddhas are often, sometimes they're singing about non-duality. They're singing about innate Buddha nature, which is common to Mahayana and Vajrayana. But sometimes they're also singing about tantric practice, about bliss, and about taking bliss as a path, and also taking the body as a path. So, of course, in Vajrayana, in tantric practice, the body becomes very important. The body becomes the vehicle through which we. Meditate, in which we meditate, and through which we attain insight. So, not just the mind, but the whole body is brought into the equation in tantric practice. So, you see in the songs of these Mahasiddhas mentions of the body, singing about the body also. You also see in their songs a lot of paradox, a lot of paradox. And the reason for the paradox is the similar reason that paradox is used in vipassana techniques. So in vipassana techniques, such as look at your own face, right? The traditional Tibetan instruction for when you sit in Mahamudra, you're given the instruction, look at your own face. How can you see your own face? You can't see your own face, right? I mean, not literally, anyway. So these kinds of instructions, Vipassana instructions, always contain some kind of paradox to get us to work with, similar to a koan practice, get us to work with, what does this mean, look at your own face? And then we try to enact, look at your own face. And in the process of processing it in the context of a wider set of meditation instructions, we are or we could say we trip over our own logical mind and land in a non-linear, non-logical space of non-conceptuality. So paradox is useful to trip us up and set us down in some place where we're not thinking so hard. We think ourselves to exhaustion and end up in this place of not thinking so hard. So paradox is a useful tool. And you find paradox a lot in these songs. Paradox. Contradiction. Okay, so I believe in standing breaks. So why don't we stand up together and I'll lead us through just some very gentle stretches. We'll take a nice inhale and grab a wrist and exhale. And inhale up. And exhale to the side. Inhale up again. And exhale side. Inhale up.
Inhale up and stretch up tall. And we're going to exhale and just take a swan dive to the floor. Just diving down as far as you can go. You don't have to reach the floor, but just giving yourself some stretch in the back of your legs, getting some blood moving to our brains and hands and arms. You want to stretch your, move your hips back and forth a little. Loosen up your lower back. And we'll slowly roll up. So what is this? You know, you sent me the schedule. Can you remind me when we break? 12th. Okay, that's very soon. All right. All right. So you have some copies here of some of the songs that we're going to look at, the songs we're going to look at. And we're going to start with number 22. Looking at one of Sadaha's songs. He says, "You're deceived by meditation." Do you see that? Do you see number 22?
Yeah.
Okay. "You're deceived by meditation, so why meditate?" "Of what cannot be spoken, why speak?" I'm breaking Sadaha's rule. "The whole world's deceived by the seal of existence, and no one can perfect their inmost nature." I love those last lines. So you're deceived by meditation. So why meditate? What does this mean? Anybody want to give it a stab? Yeah.
I was just going to say effort's part of the confusion.
Effort's part of the confusion. Good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we're trying to improve ourselves or achieve something, get better in some way.
Right. We think we're making something better.
Also, we think there's someone doing something. Mm-hmm. So the self, we can just remake the self in trying to meditate.
Yet another selfing project. Mm-hmm. Right. That's right. Yeah, meditation. So many possible deviations. Efforting, too much efforting, over-efforting, especially when we first learn to meditate, we tend to over-effort, almost exclusively over-effort. You might say sometimes under-effort, but when we're on the cushion, we want to do it right. So we tend to over-effort. Yeah. And believing there's somebody doing the meditating. And this idea that there's some improvement that can happen here. Some improvement, some making better. But he tells us in the last line, no improvement possible. No improvement possible. That's great. That's great. Well, it's actually really a relief. Because then sitting on our cushion is not about meditating. Sitting on our cushion is about not meditating. So this instruction of non-meditation, is very important. The three pith instructions for Mahamudra meditation. Don't contrive. Don't meditate. And don't be distracted. The three don'ts for Mahamudra meditation. Non-contrivance, non-meditation, non-distraction. The three points of Mahamudra. So he's pointing to the first of these points. So then what do we do if we're not meditating?
What do we do? Anybody? Give it a shot?
Self-awareness.
Self-awareness? Good. Awareness aware of itself. Good. Yes? What do we do? Others?
We're relaxing.
Relaxing. We are relaxing. That's good. Relaxing in the deepest way, this ultimate letting go. So in the meditation we just did together this morning, too, the instruction, if the mind, it's from Sadhaka also, if the mind is relaxed, it will free itself. Have no doubt. Okay, so one of the profound doors into this style of meditation, natural meditation or Mahamudra meditation, which is the kind of meditation practiced by these Mahasiddhas, also would go in line with Dzogchen, too. If any of you are familiar with Dzogchen but not Mahamudra, it would work perfectly well for Dzogchen also, is this idea that you can't force it. That if you deeply let go and you deeply relax, your Buddha nature knows how to do it. You don't have to make the Buddha nature do it. The Buddha nature knows how to meditate itself. Or, as the way that he puts it, if you relax, your mind will free itself. Your nature will free itself. But it doesn't mean, like, lay back on the couch and watch TV and eat potato chips, relax. It's a certain kind of a stance of being. It might be, actually, in the Mahasiddha model, that you are laying back on the couch, eating potato chips and watching TV and resting in the natural state. You could be. But it's more as an inner stance than an outer relaxation stance. It's an inner stance of letting go. Yeah. So non-meditation. So what do? We don't meditate. We non-meditate. Or another way we could think of it in really practical terms, because now you're sitting on your cushion, right? You're up in the morning at 6:30 and you're on your cushion and like, darn, I'm not supposed to meditate. Well, one instruction I found really helpful, well, relax is one. Oh, just relax. I mean, ultimate, let it go. Let go of everything. Let go of my thoughts. Let go of my clinging. Let go of my holding to any kind of life raft whatsoever. And be natural, rest in the natural state. But if that's difficult, if we need something else, one instruction I found really useful is just be. That is the instruction of pure being or non-doing, the instruction of non-doing. Because our habit is so much a doing habit. I must do, I must meditate, I must contrive this perfect state of nirvana or something close, or some sort of freedom, I need to make that happen, right? We're so involved, and how are we going to make that happen? And then, oh, and then also pining. Oh, it's not happening. You know, I'm such a bad meditator. I'm never going to make it, right? So we're all kinds of sorts of contrivance, all kinds of framing and conceptualizing. So the wonderful thing about the non-meditation, it's just permission to just let it all go and stop doing all of it. Just stop doing. And stop doing doesn't necessarily mean the mind is going to stop, right? The mind is not going to stop. The mind is not going to stop chattering away, especially when we're first meditating. The mind is going to keep on chattering away. But what we're learning is not to be hooked by the chatter, so that we can just let that come and go in the way that clouds come in the sky and clouds go. Clouds dissolve back into the sky. We don't have to be, this is what contrivance is. Contrivance is enmeshment. Like, if we want to know what is contrivance, you know, when I first heard it, I really thought of it as building and constructing. And then we ask the question a lot, am I doing contrivance? Am I not doing contrivance? But in the end, contrivance is just getting really enmeshed in our thoughts and feelings. If we're not enmeshed, we're moving towards non-contrivance, the ability to allow, the really deeply allow this stuff to come up and to dissolve, to be the space instead of be the clouds, be the space. Yeah. So why, of what cannot speak, why, of what cannot be spoken, why speak? What's that? What's that? What cannot be spoken, why speak? breaking the rules. Anyone want to give that one a shot? I like to hear what you guys have to say, because you do a much better job than I do by myself.
Express,
good. Yeah. Express, and why express or not express?
The human nature.
Mm-hmm. Human nature to express. Of what cannot be spoken. So say more, Ashok.
It appears that we're wired. When we are born, we cry, we shout.
Mm-hmm.
So right from there,
mm-hmm.
we are born to express ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a natural quality of a human.
Okay, it's a natural quality of a human being to express. Why does he say, why speak of what cannot be spoken?
Is he referring to just the emptiness?
The emptiness, yeah, emptiness.
It's indescribable, so.
Okay, good. It's indescribable. Yeah. So it's true, we may well be born to express. Look, we're born with language, or with the seeds of language, but emptiness can't be spoken of. Emptiness can't be spoken of. What else? Yeah.
Beyond thought. So
all right.
We talk with thoughts, so we've gone beyond them.
Gone beyond them. Okay, good. So the state of resting, I could say resting in this relaxed, natural state, self-awareness, awareness seeing itself, is indescribable beyond even concept. So how could language capture that? Right.
So how can you describe undescribable?
Right. How can you describe what's undescribable? Right. How can you describe what's undescribable?
But there's also no need to, because, you know, like you're saying, it's there are no concepts to express. There's nothing to express, so why even try?
Right. Why even try? Right. Why even try?
So just rest. You know, I think of language as being external also, you know, trying to send something out.
Mm-hmm.
But really, when you're resting in the natural state, your experience is within.
Mm-hmm.
So there'd be no need to speak.
No need to speak, right. Good.
You're always dragging yourself into it. You create a dualistic situation.
Right.
Automatically.
So language is naturally dualistic. Is that what you're saying?
What's that?
Language is naturally dualistic.
Yeah.
Yeah, when we start talking, we have an I and then something else out there, or I am experiencing X. And already we've got two things there. We're separate from our experience. We're not intimate with our experience. Now, one of the cool things about these songs, you know, these songs have different names as a genre. So these songs are called Doha. In Sanskrit, they're referred to as Doha. They're also referred to as Vajra Doha. Doha means song. And Vajra Doha, Dorje Lu, means like an indestructible song. An indestructible song, because it's singing about something that is indestructible. Singing about our true nature. Singing right out of the true nature. Another cool thing about these songs, and the songs of the Mahasiddhas in general, another name for these songs, Nyamnyongi Lu, Nyamnyongi Gur in Tibetan, songs of experience. So the Vajra songs are also sometimes labeled as a genre, songs of experience, which I love, because it describes exactly what differentiates these songs from other styles of writing and expression in the Tibetan literature. What's neat about these songs is it's always somebody expressing their experience. So it is kind of ironic that he's saying, what can be spoken, why speak? And yet he's singing the song. Yet Saraha is singing the song. And which is very cool, too. That's another paradox, that he's actually is speaking. He is speaking. He is giving words to his experience. He's speaking directly out of his experience. And in this way, too, I think these songs are such a good model for us as meditators, and also beginning meditators, intermediate meditators, advanced meditators. They're reminding us, they're modeling how not to be divorced from your experience. They're saying, don't be divorced from what you're experiencing in the present moment. Look at that. Speak from that. Practice from that. You know, also in our practice in general, and in the Buddhist practices in general, and maybe in any meditative tradition, but certainly in the Buddhist tradition, this idea of freedom, or Mahamudra, or Dzogchen, or can become like this holy grail that's somewhere out there in the future, and we're going to get it someday. You know, this idea of freedom as being somewhere out there in the future, not right here in this present moment. So as long as we're still thinking out that way and projecting as to what this wonderful taste we're going to have in the future that's going to be so great, we start divorcing ourselves from this present moment of experience, which is where the freedom will be found. It's not going to be found anywhere else. Not going to be found anywhere other than right here. Other than right here, right now, really. That's the only, you could say, the only landscape that's going to open up freedom for us is right here, right now. So the Mahasiddha songs are always right here, right now. So Sadaha saying, this is what's right here, right now for me. And that's why I love these songs so much, too. Yeah, you had a question.
I'm just wondering if these are truly songs. Yeah, I've always wondered about that. You know, I get this image of this time when everyone's bursting into song. Great musical. But thinking about the part of our brain that is connected to song, which is different than the part that's language, and that is this sort of indestructible part. The most deepest part. I work with people with dementia, and when I start doing music with them, they wake up. They know the kind of place when they're like not present. Suddenly, the light comes on, and they start remembering and singing. And so it just makes me kind of muse about all that, about just the brain and.
I think it's very likely. He argues in the introduction that it's very likely, this translator, Roger Jackson, that it was song and not just poetry. I think it's likely because in the living tradition, these dohas are chanted, and they're chanted to tunes. They're not just spoken. If you go to a monastery and you look at how do these dohas get actually used, they'll be in a hall with many monks chanting the Doha, treasury of dohas, once a year, including this set. And they'll be chanting them to tunes, basically singing them together. Yeah. So I would guess, and they're in verse. So I think there's a good argument to be made. They were songs. And if you look at how the living tradition of Buddhism in Asia exists, if you go into any monastery in all of Asia, pretty much, at least from my experience, there will be songs. We might call them chants, but songs or chants that have tunes that are sung or chanted, however you want to say, every day with a tune. And that is a mnemonic device that makes it much easier to memorize these songs and poems and prayers because they have the tune with them. And also, of course, more evocative. I mean, that's just only experientially, but if you sing something with a tune, it gets really deep into the heart somehow. It's just, that's not very scientific, but I think so.
I have a question. From their experience, they just realized the nature of their mind through all of their training. So no one gave them pointing out instructions. It was just
no. They had gurus. Okay. They had gurus. In fact, Sadaha's guru was a woman. We know that much. We don't know who she was, but he sings about her as his guru, and he's always with her. It's always a her that teaches him. No, they all had gurus, and they all sing about their gurus. So this was not coming out of nowhere. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, there was lineage here, lineage and teachers and practice, and yeah. But they're still singing out of what they see, you know, which is why I love the Dohas. They're not singing about, this is what my teacher has told me enlightenment is like. They're singing, they're saying, this is what I see in my practice. Yeah, and they do sing about their teachers, but not so much about what their teachers said as to what their teachers opened up within their own experience and then singing from there.
Just thinking, is that really a good practice for us to do? I mean, in our meditation, to just write our own dohas.
I think it's powerful to do that. I've done a bit of that. I did that in 3-year retreat, but it can be a distraction if you happen to be somebody who's really literary or really wordy. Then it can be more like, ooh, what do I see now? Oh, now what do I see? And then you're not actually meditating so much. But I think it's a great practice. Yeah. Yeah, and I've actually thought about that as a possible retreat to do someday, have a retreat where what we do is meditate and then once a day write a doha just to express what we're seeing. Because it is a powerful practice to put it down. I think it's neat, a neat model. So going through, I'll finish the few lines of this, just going over them, and then maybe we'll move on to one more before lunch. So the whole world is deceived by the seal of existence. The whole world is deceived by the seal of existence, and no one can perfect their inmost nature. Those are kind of two ideas. The whole world is deceived by the seal of existence, and no one can perfect their inmost nature. So what's that? Anybody? I like it when you guys start it off. Dharma discussion.
The deception being the projection experiences out there.
Uh-huh.
It's very compelling.
Good. That experience is out there.
Yeah. It appears through the sense doors.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Projection. And projecting on that as true. No?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good. Good.
Does the seal refer to Mahamudra?
I don't think so. But, you know, it might actually be a reference because it's got to be. Actually, let's look. Yeah, my Sanskrit isn't all that great. I do know it, but I'm not very good at it. So I can't actually tell which word there is seal, and they don't have the Tibetan. But it might be a play on that. Instead of the Chaja Chembo, instead of the great seal, the sort of samsaric seal, the seal of existence. Yeah, the seal of samsara. I bet it is a play on that. Because back then they had Mahamudra as, actually mudra is seal. Mudra is seal. Mudan. Mudan. Bhava mudan. That's it. Bhava mudan.
There's a note.
Mudan. Oh. There it is. Yeah, samsara. Its seal is the pleasures and enticements of the world, which make it appear more substantial and satisfactory than it really is. He quotes from Leonard Cohen, the great Buddhist master. You are locked into your suffering and your pleasures are the seal. That's pretty cool. What a great line. It must be in his one of his songs. That's cool. The world's deceived by the seal of samsara, the seal of existence. Samsara. Yeah. So samsara, like on the most basic level, is just this bifurcation into subject and object, a perceiving subject and perceived objects, this dualism. It's locked into this dualism. I think that's what he's saying. The world is locked into this dualistic clinging. And then no one can perfect their inmost nature. I just love that one. I just love it. So what he's singing about there is our Buddha nature. Our Buddha nature, or our nature of mind. Our nature of mind, Semji Neluk. The way of being of our awareness. So no one can make that any better. No one, we can't make it any better. So no matter how hard we practice, we're not going to get any better. We're not going to get any better. Uh-huh. We're not going to, in an ultimate sense, in a relative sense, yeah, maybe we'll get better. But all of meditation is really just setting up the conditions for something that's innate to make itself manifest. It's not making the Buddha nature better, or making our nature of mind more shiny and pretty, more attractive and deep and profound. So the lovely thing about that, no one can perfect their inmost nature, is it strips off what is really the spiritual path, what is our Buddhist path, what is our path. Our path becomes a path of discovery. Not a path of creating something out of nothing or creating something that wasn't previously present. It's just a path of discovering what's already present. And all of our practice then begins to be that becoming not more complicated, but less complicated, more simple, more noticing the innate, our innate nature. So no one can perfect their inmost nature. And the reverse is also true. No terrible actions, no matter how terrible, can make it any worse, which is a bit of a relief. It means that, you know, even if we've made terrible mistakes in our lives and we've done really what we could say the wrong things, wrong choices that we made, or what we see as a wrong choice, or like now we look back with regret. But whatever it is that we did that we now regret did not sully our Buddha nature. That's still pristine, pure, primordially perfect just as it is. So that's also a relief, because it gives us some permission to discover that innate, that it's not, when we discover it, going to have been damaged by something. It just is as it is. It is what it is. No one can perfect. Yeah.
So if they don't impact our innate nature, what about sankharas?
Samskaras.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they, as we do, like karma.
Uh-huh. Yes, right. But that doesn't impact our innate nature. It impacts our relative self. And the relative self is important. The relative is important. But the ultimate is what we're eventually getting at. But we can't get at the ultimate without attending to the relative. So we can't overlook karma. We can't overlook good works. We can't overlook any of the paramitas of generosity and patience and diligence and the qualities of bodhicitta and loving kindness and compassion. All of those qualities are so important, but they're setting up the conditions for us to recognize the innate. And also, from the point of view of the Mahamudra and the Dzogchen traditions, those relative good qualities are kind of like the rainbow light that is cast by a diamond. So if our diamond is our true nature, then how it expresses itself is through compassion and loving kindness and patience and love. So those are like the colors, the rainbow colors of that jewel that's innate. But by attending to the relative karma, we help could say, perforate holes in, could say, that cocoon that is covering our Buddha nature. We start to perforate holes through it by attending to the karma. If we're accumulating negative karma, it's like we're slapping on more mud onto the cocoon, so we can't see that nature very
polishing.
Clearly. Yeah, like polishing the diamond. Right? Good. Yeah. Since we do have a few, let's introduce one more. Let's do one more song. Sweet. Okay, so let's look at 32. Hey, I like it when they start their songs with, hey, hey, wake up, hey, don't make problems for self-awareness, existence, nothingness, fortune, and I think probably he means fortune and loss. I think he didn't have enough syllables. Because existence and nothingness are a pair, and he may have meant fortune and loss, but just mentioned fortune. Hey, fool, they're bondage. Think the inmost thought completely, yogin. It's just like water mixing in with water. Just like water mixing in with water. So, hey. Don't make problems for self-awareness. I like that one, too. Anybody want to try that? Any of our audience commentators? You have to get used to this. I'm not a conventional Dharma teacher. I like to pull the wisdom of the group. Don't make problems for self-awareness.
Don't follow the discursive mind.
There, okay, don't follow the discursive mind. Okay, good. Don't follow the discursive mind. Don't make problems for self-awareness. And why would following the discursive mind make a problem for self-awareness?
Because it's always like a shield, sort of. It's always like a barrier.
A barrier, okay.
I'm always thinking it's real.
Mm-hmm, okay. Yeah, our thoughts are real, our distractions are real, yeah.
Trungpa Rinpoche gives instruction about not to squeeze the mind.
Don't squeeze the mind. Mm. What do you think he means?
Don't impede it, don't try to cramp its own style, so to speak.
Good. Don't impede it, don't cramp its style. I love it, don't cramp its style. I'm totally going to write that down right now. That's good. That's a good one. Yeah, don't cramp its style. Don't get in your own way. Get out of your own way, really. So all of Mahamudra practice, natural meditation, is a long arc of getting out of your own way. So that's also what's meant by this idea of if you completely relax, the mind will free itself. Stop trying to free your mind. Stop trying to free your mind. Just let your mind free itself. Self-liberate. Now, that's not something that's easy to do. No, not necessarily easy to do. And also when we first hear it, we're going to be working with it, struggling with it, this instruction. What does it mean to let the mind self-liberate? And all kinds of doubts. Am I doing it? Am I not doing it? Am I doing it right? You know, it takes a long time to trust ourselves, to trust our self-awareness and get out of the way and let it manifest itself. And at first, that's really difficult because of our discursive thoughts. So we're running after the discursive thoughts. We're running after them. We're paying attention to them. We're not paying attention. We're not resting in the knower, the thinker who is the non-thinker. We're running after the projection. We're running after the projection, not resting in the source, the projector. We're running after the projections, not resting in the projector. So he's saying don't make problems for self-awareness. The witness, calls it here in the footnote. So don't get in the way of the witness. Let the witness be all that we are resting in. The selfless witness. So then he says, existence, nothingness, fortune, and I think it's probably fortune and loss, having seen some of these songs before, and also similar songs, where if they just don't have room, because they're trying to fit into the metered verse, they're very, very good about not making the meter go longer or shorter. It's exactly the same syllables on each line. So they'll drop a word here and there. They'll drop grammar particles all over the place to make it fit. So it might be, so the sense of being and non-being, fortune and loss, or attachment to gain and loss, these eight worldly dharmas along those lines. So he's saying these are bondage. These are bondage. Why? Why are they bondage? Existence and non-existence and gain and loss.
Because they're concepts.
They're concepts.
When you're speaking, you're just going back to speaking of what you can't speak about.
Okay, all right. They're concepts, right? Yes.
There's also no way out. It's a vicious.
It's a cycle, right?
There's no out if you're in that.
Right. Right. So it's related to this attachment and aversion and ignorance that are our three basic emotional kleshas, our emotional kleshas, or our cognitive and emotional kleshas. The Buddha taught there were three that are sort of the, we could say they're the three seeds out of which everything else proliferates. Greed and jealousy and all the rest proliferate out of attachment, aversion, and ignorance. Attachment, aversion, and ignorance. And because of the attachment, aversion, and ignorance, we spin thoughts of this exists and that doesn't exist. We begin to make judgments and we attach and label. And from that comes, I like this and I don't like that. And from that comes, if I get this, I'm happy. And if I get this, I suffer. Or if I get this pain over here, I suffer. If I get this good thing over here, I'm happy. And that proliferates into karma. And that proliferates into the cycle of samsara. So he's talking about that. They're bondage. So these ideas of good and bad, yes and no, existence, non-existence, they're sometimes called these the extremes, right? Yeah.
It also seems like, you know, bondage is something that holds us down or holds us back. So then we're not multifaceted. There's no creativity that can arise. There's no, you know, freedom. There's no other thinking or, you know, so then how could we... When we're in bondage, we can't think of anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
We're stuck
in
our own place. And it's like we're our own jailer. We're we're the one that keeps us, that holds us down.
Right. Good. Yeah, we're the ones that keep us in bondage. Mm-hmm. Right. And those kinds of thoughts. Well, we can even see we don't have to go that far from our own mind at any given moment. You know, we experience that bondage a lot. So if we look at many ways. So, for example, how we judge others as, oh, I like this person, I don't like that person, or I've decided this is a certain type of person. So even as they approach us, we're already weighing, I like, I don't like. And where's the freedom then to have true love and compassion for that person? And we've closed ourselves off from the possibility of that already, even as they approach. So then what do we do instead? What do we do instead? So, think the inmost thought completely, Yogin.